Hello, everybody. It's Mike Norman here, and I am doing a podcast. It's been a long time, actually, since I have done a podcast, and kind of in the mood to do one, so I have decided to record this today. Lot going on today. A lot has been going on, obviously, for the past month or longer, actually, since my last podcast, which I'm not even sure when that was. But for starters, today, unusual situation, a unexpected shutdown of the New York Stock Exchange, which had to completely halt trading because of it was reported initially as a technical glitch. It ended up to be a technical glitch. But what made it so odd, I think, at least for me, was the fact that it wasn't just the New York Stock Exchange. You had United Airlines, which grounded its entire fleet of airplanes today because of technical or computer-related problems. You had the Wall Street Journal, whose internet site was shut down. And I hear that you also had Zero Hedge, not that I missed that thing at all. But just the three of those, the New York Stock Exchange, the Wall Street Journal, United Airlines, I don't know. I mean, my first impression was some kind of cyber attack was going on, right? I mean, we've seen incidences of cyber attacks recently emanating. Usually they've been coming out of China. So that was my first reaction was, hey, this is some kind of a cyber attack. And if it is, boy, that they really took it to another level to cause the New York Stock Exchange to shut down United Airlines and the Wall Street Journal. But I could sort of early on in the closure of the stock exchange, not physically closing, but the halt of trading. There were news reports that the FBI said, you know, there was no need for an investigation by them. And some people, I like, you know, there's always that conspiracy element out there. And I read some people actually commented on my Facebook page when I posted up the story about the New York Stock Exchange being closed. If the FBI is denying it, well, then it's probably true that it was a cyber attack. In any case, everything's back up and running. Actually, by the time the NYSE got started trading again, it was pretty much near the close, or it was at the close. But it was orderly. There was no sense of panic. So that was the good news. The bad news was stock market. The Dow was down 260 points today. You had a rough start right from the very beginning with the Chinese stock market falling another 5%. I want to talk a little bit about that Chinese stock market, because there's been all kinds of, panic and worry and people decrying the bursting of the bubble. And I wrote an article about this today on realmoneyatthestreet.com. A lot of people, in my opinion, a lot of people, this whole bursting of the bubble in China story, it's completely misguided. Okay, these are people who, and by the way, you have some big hedge fund names who are buying into this thing. You have not buying the market, I mean buying into the story. Guys like Jim Chanos, who's a big short seller, and you know, he's on CNBC all the time, and he's been talking constantly about China being a bubble. I don't know if the guy is short. He claims not to be short, but you know, he's a short seller. I think his claim of not being short is maybe out of embarrassment. I don't know, because I mean, he was talking about shorting the Chinese market when it was down at around 1800, then it ran all the way up to 5000. You know, now it's down in near 3500 or so it's given back about 30 or more percent. But it had a, you know, a doubling. It had like 115% run up from last November until recently. And, you know, a lot of that, especially in the last several months when it hit, the, you know, running up to the peak, it was highly speculative. It was, you know, driven by aggressive monetary policy by the Chinese Central Bank. So the market needs a correction. I mean, it's not normal for something to go straight up, even if it is being pushed that way by the central bank. I mean, at some point, they stop, they wait, they see the reaction. They may be even on their own thinking that, hey, you know, we're pushing a little bit too far on the gas here, so you have a pullback. But the story about the Chinese bubble, this is revolves around this belief, and that's what it is. It's a belief. It's not a fact. It's a belief that China has this massive amount of debt. You know, it's very similar to the Japan story, only here with China, they look at the debt of the banks in China, the banking system, enormous amounts of debt, enormous amounts of credit has been extended. And these people are saying, well, you know, this is unsustainable and this is highly speculative. And, you know, the classic stories that we hear all the time. What they don't say, or the distinction that they don't quite get, is that China's state banks, you know, the government-owned banks, are essentially fiscal arms of the Chinese government. The lending that is done through the state banks is basically lending by decree, by mandate. Okay, so they're actually, you could look at it, these loans, as basically a fiscal injection. Now, what happens, all these loans are in yuan, okay, just as all of China's quote-unquote debts are denominated in its own currency, yuan. Right? There's no external debt. China does not have debt in any foreign currency. All taxes paid by Chinese citizens are paid in yuan, and the Chinese government first, of course, has to spend that yuan into existence before anyone has that currency to pay taxes. So it's the same situation as what we have here. It's a sovereign currency issuing nation. Okay, so it could spend in its own currency, you know, till kingdom come. The fact that it directs a lot of that spending through loans by banks is somewhat of a different setup than what we have here in the United States, but nonetheless, it equates to a fiscal injection. For example, what happens? Let me backtrack for a second. I guess the belief on the part of those who are screaming about a credit bubble in China is the belief that somehow if these loans go bad, if these loans denominated in the Chinese currency, in renminbi, if they go bad, that somehow what? The China's going to run out of its currency? Is that the, and go bankrupt because it no longer has the ability to pay or credit bank accounts in its own currency? I mean, this has to be the thought process of people who are, you know, worried about a credit bubble in China. They obviously don't understand the monetary system over there. They don't understand the economy. And they conflate the situation, as they always do, as they did in Japan. You have the guys like, you know, Kyle Bass, and, you know, they're not going to have enough tax revenue to pay, and they're not going to be able to make, you know, it's just, it's ridiculous. It's completely and utterly ridiculous. So I do not buy into this credit bubble scenario. What I do think is that the market had a huge run-up in China. I think a lot of that was driven by very aggressive monetary policy by the Chinese Central Bank. I think they got a little nervous and they pulled back a little bit and the market started coming down and everyone piled in. You know, people wanted to short the market, and then there were a lot of people who were long, highly levered, and they were getting margin calls, and So the thing has undergone a correction. But what we have seen recently, now, you know, you have to understand something about China. First of all, and yes, I will admit that you have a lot of these Western educated kids right now, maybe learning the junk economics here in the United States. Maybe they went to Harvard or University of Chicago. They get taught the junk economics. They go back to China, you know, and this sort of percolates through policy a little bit, maybe on the edge, on the fringe. And so you have a little bit of that effect going on. I'm sure that's happening. And, you know, frankly, that's a problem. I would hate to see China embrace the idiocy, you know, that we have here in the West, in the United States, and certainly the idiocy, monumental idiocy that we see in Europe right now. And all this shit, you know where it comes from. It comes from, you know, the very, very entrenched mainstream academic economics, which is considered, you know, the highest level of economics, but it's garbage. It's coming from places like Harvard. It's coming from places like University of Chicago. Okay? So some of that is going on. There's no question about it. But I think China is more rational. Okay, first of all, you're not dealing with a country where you have 600 or 500 idiots in an assembly like we have here in Congress, okay? You basically have something like a couple of dozen guys who decide what's going to go on. You have a country for one that has 1.3 billion people. It's very, if you think about that, I mean, that is a staggering number, 1.3 billion people. And it is very, if China is suffering from some overcapacity right now, let's say in real estate, it's very hard for me to buy into the oversupply thesis, at least a long-lasting oversupply thesis in a country of 1.3 billion people where incomes are rising. Okay? Eventually, that supply is going to get absorbed. People, as their incomes rise, they want to trade up to nicer, you know, nicer places to live, nicer housing. There's going to be demand for that. It's going to be absorbed. Okay? So long term, I don't think that's a problem. In addition, China sees the writing on the wall. China sees the American policy of wanting to transform this country into China, basically to become the next great exporting nation, right? I mean, everything, we basically told them. We told them this is what we want to do, okay, whether you like it or not. And by the way, if you don't like it, we are going to slap all kinds of tariffs and impediments to trade and penalties. Remember back in 2005, not only did Congress threaten that, but we said to them directly, if you do not allow your currency to appreciate, we will brand you a currency manipulator, and that mandates certain tariffs and punishment, okay? And that's what happened. Since 2005, the Chinese currency has appreciated about 27% against the U.S. dollar, which basically was the amount of undervaluation that many economists put on it. So they allowed it to go there, all right? So China sees the writing on the wall. So it realizes that it needs to transition its economy from an export-driven economy into more of a domestic investment and consumption-based model, kind of like what we have here and what we have had for a very long period of time, and which what gave us for a large economy, the largest economy, the highest standard of living in the world. But, you know, apparently, that's not, you know, that's not what we want. Apparently, we want a lower standard of living, or at least the powers that be, they want a lower standard of living. So what are we going to do? We're going to keep wages down, right? we're going to sign on to trade deals that will harm our environment, that will circumvent labor laws and protections, that will allow us to offshore, all these kind of things to sustain or boost the whole entire export sector of our economy, while at the same time reducing the real terms of trade and reducing the standard of living of Americans. That's broadly what's happening here, and it's been happening for a while, and it's going to actually get worse because Obama was just granted fast track. We all know this on that TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, that still has to be voted into law, but that's probably going to happen. Remember, that deal was dead in Congress a couple of times. It was dead in the Senate, then it was dead in the House, then they resurrected it back in the House, and then they passed it, they gave him the authority in the Senate. So, you know, this is why I don't vote. This is why I don't, but what's the point of voting? I had a big discussion with somebody today on Facebook saying, you know, that's terrible that you don't vote, Mike. You have to vote. You know, voting is our responsibility. We have to take that seriously as citizens. Seriously? I mean, seriously? I should say it like that. Seriously? I mean, vote for what reason? Because no matter how I vote, first of all, in New York, if we're talking about a presidential election, I mean, and regardless, it doesn't have to be New York, whatever state you're in, unless it's a swing state, but New York is never a swing state, the electoral votes in New York are always going to go to the Democrats. So they don't need, if I want to vote Democrat, they don't need my vote. There's enough Democrats here that the state always goes Democratic. And if I want to vote Republican, it's a waste of time. You think I'm going to stand in line for an hour or 2 hours and go vote for a freaking wasted vote? And by the way, even if I wanted to do that, getting back to my original point, I don't vote, and here's why I don't vote, because it's a sham. It's a total sham. Because at the end of the day, regardless of who gets elected, the owners of the country are going to get what they want, okay? The owners of the country, and you know who I'm talking about, that's the billionaires, that's the big corporations, right? That's the elite. They are going to get what they want. Remember Obama? Remember change you can believe in? What change? That's, you know, the question I'd like to ask. What exactly changed? I mean, if you look at any measure of middle class well-being, who supposedly that's who, you know, he was fighting, he was supposedly, his whole campaign was about that, right? About workers. I'll put on a comfortable pair of shoes and I'll walk the picket line, right? Meanwhile, that whole thing in Wisconsin with the collective bargaining, not a peep out of Obama, not a peep. So what changed? Any metric of middle class well-being right now, if you take any metric, if you take wages and salaries, if you take home ownership, okay? If you take jobs and job availability and employment, all right? If you take debt levels, okay? Any metric of middle class well-being is way below where it was when Bush was in office. And that, I'm not saying that as a kudos or a, you know, to try to make Bush look like he was this great president, because the collapse in labor share of national income, which started, you know, back in 2000, 2001, I mean, really started with Reagan, okay? But I mean, it just fell off the cliff. It started to fall off the cliff under Bush, and then that trend has continued with Obama. So, you know, what changed? The guy got 65 million votes. You know, nothing happened. If you look at things like, you could look at other, rather than economic metrics, you could look at societal metrics, incarceration rates, right? How many people in prison? It's way up there at a peak. Maybe peaking out a little bit, but you know, over 2 million population, prison population, the largest anywhere by far. So that's why I don't vote. It doesn't make a difference. It does not make a difference. And even on a local level, you know, maybe I don't even know if it makes any difference on a local level, because it just doesn't. It just doesn't. Anyway, so I think China, personally, I think you got to buy into this dip, okay? I think they see the writing on the wall. They're moving through a transition in their economy. They recently said last month that, in fact, they announced that they were deliberately targeting, they were targeting higher deficit levels, okay? And they were going to use the money to invest into infrastructure and job creation. We hear a lot about that here in the United States, but, you know, that's just talk over here. Job creation. So they're on the right track. And, you know, every once in a while they can get tripped up. Look, I'll be the first one to say that over-reliance on monetary policy over the past couple of years, like all these other idiot industrialized countries, we've taken fiscal policy off the table. Everything's got to be monetary policy, which, you know, you talk about this big national discussion we're having about income inequality. A lot of that has to do with monetary policy being the sole economic policy tool, right? I mean, that benefits the 1% or the 1/10 of 1%. Right, increase the level, the value of financial assets. Poor people don't own stocks, even middle class people. Hey, how many stock? You know, they really. You might have a 401k, but I mean, for most people's 401ks are completely insufficient to sustain them in retirement. Okay, and the ones that have enough, if you're still in that category of middle class. I mean, it's barely enough, right? You got to move to some really low-cost place to live off of that. So, I mean, come on. All that stuff all benefits the rich. It benefits the wealthy. So, enough of that. I guess I'll make a couple of comments here about Greece. And, it's very frustrating. It's beyond frustrating. It's annoying. It grates on me to continue to write for the blog and say, oh, they caved in again. Okay, here's the deal. Well, you know, all these fucking Sunday meetings and maybe something's going to happen and there's going to be a deal or, you know, we're backing off. We voted no. Fuck you. Democracy is back. And then the next thing you know, okay, well, they're slinking back. With their tails, Tsipras is slinking back with his tail between his legs, wanting to make a deal. Now, some people say, well, Mike, what choice do they have? What options do they have? Either you make the deal, right, because they lost the gambit. They didn't lose the gambit. I'll tell you what options they have. And by the way, Bill Mitchell wrote an excellent, he always, you know, he writes great stuff. I rarely read his stuff just because it's so long. Like, how does he do that every day? That's just an amazing, prolific, you know, output that he has. But he wrote a great piece about, and the title of the piece was Grexit, it does not require rocket science. And he walked through the whole process. We put it up on the blog here on Mike Norman Economics. And by the way, you know, he was saying that the printing presses are still there in Athens. You know, there was this big story on the internet, a bogus story about how Greece, in order to get it, you know, to be accepted into the euro, the eurozone, they had to smash their print. That was it. They smashed all the printing. Oh, we got to smash. Take out the smasher. You know, like I could just picture the printing presses being thrown in one of those big car crushers, right? Smash them. So this was a big story. They're still there. Okay, they're still functioning. The Greek central bank has the, and its mint has the ability to mint coins and print euros, because that, you know, that was all farmed out by the ECB to the various central banks. Okay, so all functioning, everything's in place. Okay, no problem with reintroducing the drachma again. Now, a couple of little things that they have to be very careful about. Number one is when they make the changeover, they have to, at the same time, immediately legislate or mandate within Greece that the new drachma will be the only acceptable currency to pay Greek taxes. Okay, that is an absolute requirement, or it could be phased in, let's say, over a short period of time, but that absolutely, the dual currency thing, the ability to extinguish Greek tax liabilities with euro has to go away. It has to go away for the new drachma to really, you know, achieve any value, to have any value. So that has to be done, then, and that might need to be legislated away, all right, number one. Once that's done, then immediately there is a need for drachma, because firms, individuals have tax obligations, and we know all the history of Greece with the very lax tax collections. They're going to have to get on the ball with that, you know, but these are things that can be achieved. There's no question about it. Now, granted, Greece is a small country. It is not Argentina. You know, Argentina is a big country with a great amount of agricultural production, mineral wealth, etc. But Greece does have agricultural products, wheat, corn, barley, things of that nature, wine, fruits and vegetables, tomatoes. It has some mining industries over there. And of course, it has a big tourism industry. And so, like Bill Mitchell said in his post, you know, right away, guess who's going to be flocking there? Will be German tourists who love to go to the warm sunshine in the wind, you know, with the pasty skin that they have, and it's horrible, horrible. Well, my son lives in Berlin, and he's complaining all the time. So they're going to be flocking to Greece at bargain basement. Hotels will be cheap as hell. You know, beach resorts will be cheap as hell. It'll be an immediate influx of tourist dollars. And at some point, it'll stabilize. Now, initially, yes, a lot of the Greek people's savings will be wiped out, but they're going to be wiped out anyway. They've already been wiped out. The economy lost about 30% of its, you know, output. 30% of national income has been vaporized through austerity. So the amount beyond that, I mean, yeah, they're going to take another hit, but then as the economy recovers, which I believe will happen relatively soon after, the drachma will start going back up again. As their economy starts improving, they'll be able to tap into some credit. I'm sure that some of these vulture funds and hedge funds will be happy to step in because of the potential returns that they're going to make. And the Greek people will be free once again. And, okay, Greece was never a perfect place. Like I said in my video the other day, you know, there was always mismanagement there. There was always corruption. But you know what? We have no business talking about corruption when the United States is probably one of the most corrupt. You saw what happened with the other day with Eric Holder, who never prosecuted a single financial executive, never went to jail, was never prosecuted in the years where they were openly admitting to fraud and currency manipulation and LIBOR rigging and mail and wire fraud and tax evasion and on and on and on. And the firms were given fines, which amounted to a small pittance of their annual earnings, and not a single bank or financial executive was ever prosecuted by Eric Holder when he was at DOJ. And then you saw why the other day, because he comes out and gets at least a $2 million a year salaried job at his old law firm, which is one of the biggest lobbyists for the banking sector. So you can't talk about corruption in Greece. You cannot lecture these countries. The United States cannot lecture these countries. People here cannot lecture Greece. I am sorry. Look at your own freaking, at my own country too. Okay? All right. Anyway, I think that's going to be it for today, folks. By the way, I just want to say this. You guys have been great. You have been fantastic. You have been terrific. The blog is doing so great. The readership is growing. I love all your comments. You know, I love the combative nature of the site. You know, we have a lot of different personalities on here. I'm on here, and, you know, we got Tom and Matt Franco and Roger and Justin and a bunch of others that contribute, and all of you who read it and all of you who, you know, pitch in on the comments. Let's make this thing happen, okay? It's happening. We are carving out a niche here. Nobody does it like we do. And when I say we, I don't mean myself and the people who write the articles or post the articles. I mean all of us, you, the readers. It's because of you, the readers. And I am so appreciative. I just want you to know that. And I really think that we have a great future. The blog is going to expand. You know, we'll take it up to the next level this year. And, you know, we speak the truth. And we cut through the bullshit. And we really get to the essence of what is going on. There's none of that mainstream crap going on here. Okay? There's none of the company line, you know, that's being spewed out. We're for the truth here. And we pull no punches when we let that be known. All right. Well, thanks again, everybody out there. Let's keep it going. That's it for me today. Take care. Bye-bye.